It's the non-secular liberal edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, the first apocalypse of 2013, the Pope quits. Cancer charity wins with McCarthy loss, CETA in Uganda, and Christy Clark and the state of BC secularism. Let's begin episode 199.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords for politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are aware of the cosmos to know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free-thinking historian.
And my name is, it's been one of those days. Okay, I'm Don, your political science philosopher. Ethan, it's the end of the world. There's so many ways I can go with this today, but I'm going to go with the first one, which is nukes, nuclear, bombs. North Korea, they blew up another bomb. What the fuck is going on with them?
Those North Koreans.
You know, this goes into my long-held theory that the best way to spur an evil empire is to try and ignore it. So, they've had sanctions, they've tried to politically isolate North Korea and all that sort of stuff. And what has it done? It's sped up its development of nuclear weapons. For some reason, they feel as if they're being attacked or threatened for some reason. I don't know where they get that from. Maybe it's the thousands of American soldiers on their borders. It's a weird thing.
Well, you know, they are very panicky people.
It's the whole war thing. So that's one possible apocalypse of 2013. Another one, and as I say, we're only a little less than a month into the new year, and I think we already have our first apocalyptic event. This Friday, an asteroid with the menacing-sounding name of 2012 DA14 will be flying so close to the Earth that it will fly between the Earth and our geosynchronous satellites. It's expected to come within 24,000 kilometers of Earth, which, relatively speaking, is right next door. It's really, really close. Now, the asteroid's not going to hit the Earth, so don't worry about that. And even if it did hit the Earth, it's maybe a 2-megaton type bomb. So, I mean, if you happen to live in a city where it lands, pretty bad, but it's not the end of life as we know it. But there is the possibility that it would hit a satellite. Now, of course, I've watched lots of TV, and I know that if a satellite is knocked out, that it's possible for the entire civilization to break down because our machines will quit working. So I thought, hey, you know, I don't think there's anything here, but let's take a quick little inventory and see, well, what's up there and how important is it to us? Now, like I say, there are several kinds of asteroids that could, there's several kinds of satellites that could be hit. Now, most astronomical satellites, so those are the ones like the Hubble telescope and all that, the ones that us good scientific skeptics are sort of most aware of, they actually fly relatively quite close to the Earth, within hundreds of kilometers as opposed to thousands. Or they actually orbit in independent sort of non-Earth orbit. So they're like the Spitzer Space Telescope, which is a big one that had for all the sun observatories. They don't actually orbit the Earth, but they're in sort of the same orbit as the Earth, but several tens of thousands of kilometers away. Now, of course, one of the big ones that could happen is many communication satellites, to function properly, must be in what's called a geostationary orbit. So they can sort of stay above the same specific area that they're servicing. This puts them at about 37,000 kilometers from Earth. So, as you can see, 37 is much farther out than 24,000. That puts them into the Goldilocks zone of being smacked down. And these are actually the most common type of satellites out there. So that's, relatively speaking, a lot of targets to hit. Now, if one of these is knocked out, and let's say something that's really key to our society, like the internet, right? If the internet was suddenly wiped out, I think it would be at least a major hindrance to the way we live our life now. But the whole way the internet works is it's interconnected nodes. So where if one satellite gets knocked out, either others will pick up the slack, or there'll be land-based connections that will pick up the slack. So I don't think that's going to be a huge issue. Now, that being said, there are some areas that just are too far away from anything, and they do rely on these sort of geostationary orbits, satellites. So, for example, Canada's far north, the Siberia, parts of Africa. If one of these satellites were taken out, these areas could literally go black, which again would sort of be a hindrance, but I don't think it would be the end of life as we know it. I mean, it'd be really boring because you'd lose your TV, but they'd quickly put up a spare up there pretty soon and life would return to normal. Of course, another one that could affect everybody is the idea of navigational satellites. Again, lots of targets out there, geosynchronous orbit, but GPS, like the internet, is actually comprised of many, many satellites. And the idea is that you pick up a whole bunch of them, it calculates their relative distance from each other, and then you know where you are relative to that. So by its very nature, if one of them goes missing, well, there's a whole bunch of them to pick up the slack on that. And again, soon enough, they'll put up a spare one to fix it. So you're not gonna get lost or anything like that. In fact, with all the satellites, sadly, the only one that really could be of any issue is sort of the astronomical ones, and not so much because, you know, life is going to end, but I mean, it costs so much money and took so much effort to get the first one up there in the first place, they're not spares lying around. Whereas all these other ones, it's like, oh yeah, we need to have this, we need to have this, and somehow there doesn't seem to be any slow down, any reticence to put these back up. Now, one class I haven't mentioned yet is the ubiquitous yet invisible military satellites. Now, military satellites sort of pose two kind of dangers. One, if a satellite is hit, it may send out sort of a distress message, sort of saying, I've been hit, nuke Iran. Or simply, you know, just a malfunctioning system and it accidentally sends out launch codes for a nuclear missile somewhere, right? Oops. This is one of the biggest fears during the Cold War, that a computer or some electronics would malfunction and somehow trigger a nuclear war. Now, of course, you know, another risk, and perhaps one a bit more realistic, is the idea of space weapons. There have been many rumors that Russia, the USA, China, and Canada have sent up satellites that not only could take out other satellites, but could have nuclear weapons to strike Earth-bound targets. Now again, having lived through parts of the Cold War and all these sort of rumors, it seems empirically highly unlikely any of these events could have happened. If you're going to have a malfunction that would cause an actual nuclear war, probably would have happened in the 70s, you know, when technology was taking over but was still faulty. And if there were weapons out there, again, I don't think that would be a huge secret. But again, let's be the good skeptic and let's pretend. Another thing that would sort of prevent any of this from happening is that geostationary type satellites, the ones that would be the main target, actually have little navigational rockets or thrusters, so they can maintain their particular orbit. So literally, if we see the satellite heading for this particular satellite, we can move it out of the way. Right? So, you know, even if 2012 DA-14 manages to take out a couple of satellites, maybe a local problem, but nothing too big, and even then, I don't think it'd be a thing. So, if you're one of our listeners in Europe, head out early morning this Friday and look up in Virgo, because apparently it's going to transit Virgo, and you probably should be able to see it.
Well, do you hear that, universe? We're not afraid of your asteroids, so bring them on.
Yes.
Well, let's move on. Busy show today. Lots of things to discuss. A bit of enraging news for our listeners. Apologies. But it turns out that the Canadian federal government has given over $500,000 to an evangelical Christian group that describes homosexuality as a, quote, perversion and a sin, and also works in Uganda, where homosexual people face severe persecution.
Well, it's actually even worse than this. A lot of the fundamentalist evangelicalism that's occurring in Africa has been spurred on by Canadian-American evangelicals who've gone there on missionary fervors. And they don't have the same sort of social buffer that prevents them from going crazy here. But there, a lot of these institutions aren't there. So literally in Uganda, there's legislation, I think it's been approved, that would make, under certain conditions, if you are gay, you can be executed. That it is a crime. It is literally
capital offense.
Capital offense to be a homosexual in Uganda, and groups like this, you know, they support the mentality of it. Now, to be fair, the CETA funding is apparently given to this group because it does do quote unquote genuine, you know, digging of wells and that sort of thing. I went to their website to see what else they do, and they apparently have this thing about farming land and improving agriculture and that sort of area. So, in the one sense, it's offensive that this group promotes, and I agree with that. But here's a rub, Ethan, and I'm curious to know where you go with this. they do seem to use the money to do the job they're intended to do.
Well, see, that's the question. And that was brought up by the minister responsible for the Canadian International Development Agency, Julian Fantino, and who claimed that funding is doled out, quote, on merit, which I think is a funny thing to say because, you know, I'm pretty sure that there are other charities that do work, you know, in Africa or Uganda that aren't gay, anti-gay. So basically what he's saying here is that us taxpayers are going to subsidize this organization, this, I believe the Christian Crossroads thing, subsidize them so that they can look at themselves in the mirror each morning and not vomit on their own stupid homophobic views. So we get to, you know, help them deal with their self-loathing that they go out and spew this garbage. And they get to build some wells and pat themselves on the back. I mean, it's disgusting.
Well, you know, one of the things that plays into this too, and I think, you know, if our listeners have any feedback, I think I'd like to do a much more expanded show on this, is the idea of faith-based charities doing this kind of work. I mean, as I say, when I was doing some research into this, I discovered that apparently under the Harper government, religious charities, and actually Christian charities, have had an increase of somewhere up to about 40% in their funding from the Canadian federal government, whereas secular charities only had like a 5% increase. So one of the issues that arise, because we said, well, okay, if they provide the services, maybe the same, but the context that they provide it in is that we're digging this well because God sent us. You should somehow worship God in order to, you know, thank him for what we've done. Same thing when you go to religious soup kitchens and that sort of thing, right? It's not like they're forcing you to do something, but there is a heavy marketing going on, a heavy let's sell the faith here by doing this particular thing that somehow puts the people who are receiving the charity at a very uncomfortable level. It's like, you know, I don't really want to sign that. I don't really want to agree with this, but somehow if I don't, maybe you're going to take it all away from me. And that defies what I think charity really is.
Well, yeah. I mean, also the fact that the people who are funding this independently, I guess, are also being lumped in with this organization's mandate, which lists sexual sins and throws in being gay or a lesbian or a transvestite in the same category as child rape.
Yeah, no. And you know, the government has, how do I put this? This is where politicians can be very, very sort of two-faced or schizophrenic or whatever term you want to use, is they make a lot of efforts to sit there and say, you know, we're a free, accepting society and we condemn any group or anything that that vilifies homosexuality or who does anything of that sort. They're bad. And then at the same time, and usually a different minister, but the same government, sits there and says, well, they're doing good work in Africa and they meet all our charity criteria and they seem to be doing a lot of good work, so we should support them. And I mean, you get this really dichotomy. I'd really, really, really be curious to know that if instead of being a Christian group, if it was an Islamic group, whether the government would be quite so coming to its defense, or whether it would have got the money in the first place.
Well, I mean, we always, Canadian politics, especially conservative Canadian politics, definitely have a thing for Christian charity, Christian evangelicals. I mean, this Harper government has shown that time and again. And you also look at like the term when he said on merit, and you wonder, you know, what was the lack of merit that caused the, you know, Canadian Lake Research Facility to get shut down? What was the lack of merit when, you know, the Harper government defunds science research that we need in this country? So this concept of merit, I think, needs to be further explored. And likewise, you know, I have to wonder, like, at a certain point, do we have to say we obviously want charity to be done. We want people to help other people. But at what cost are we willing to sacrifice our international perception of ourselves when we send charity workers over to another country that espouse some disgusting views that, you know, here in Canada, we would not tolerate in public discord?
No, and like I say, doubly so because of where they're sending them. If this group had the same views and they were doing charity work in the Philippines or some other place where, again, it would be a horrible thing for them to do. But right now, it's a very, very hot button issue in Uganda about the whole, again, a capital offense for being homosexual in Uganda. It's just atrocious. And I want to reiterate the contrast. I was listening to... a radio show that was talking about citizenship and how they can take your citizenship away if you're somehow connected to a terrorist group. And in that conversation, they brought up Galloway, who was denied access into Canada because he brought in a humanitarian shipment in into Gaza. Now, you could quite credibly say that something like Hamas or Hezbollah do good charity work on the ground. And actually, most people who are objective viewers or judges will say, yes, you know, they do have hospitals, they have schools, they build wells, they do lots of really, really good things on the ground. But they also have this sort of bad negative thing. And again, our own government says, well, that one bad negative thing means we can't support anything they do. But when put into the context of this particular charity, it's like all is forgiven.
Yeah. Let's take a quick break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back with more after this.
A long time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
It's one small step for man.
So vote
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlick, Chairman.
There's a whale, there's a whale, there's the whale fishes blow. And the whale was in full view. Whale fish, whale fish, whale fish.
Are you a senior undergrad or graduate student wanting to supercharge your professional development and meet the right people in the ocean sciences? Then register now for Power Up, networking and training on February 27th, sponsored by Ocean Networks Canada. For more information, go to regonline.ca/poweruponc.
What sort of fish are you?
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker here on CITR. So we have a skeptical win to follow up with that skeptical rage. So last week, the Ottawa Cancer Charity decided to host a special event to raise awareness of breast cancer. The event, called Bust a Move, is designed to raise money and awareness, and so the organization decided to get a celebrity host. So, who did they pick? Jenny McCarthy.
What?
Yes, the anti-vaccination proponent Jenny McCarthy, a woman who's so anti-science, she believed that she was able to cure her son's autism with magic powers.
Wasn't her son magical to begin with, though? I thought he was some star child.
Yeah, something about that. Anyway, so Jenny McCarthy, one of the most famous anti-science proponents out there, dangerous advocate. Over the years, she's campaigned against childhood vaccinations, claiming they cause autism, and basically virtually anything evil under the sun. She's spouted her nonsense at every opportunity, including in books, national TV, The Oprah Show. She even started a massive charity.
In quotes.
Yeah, in quotes, for the purpose, which is, I think, gone belly up. But the results have been quite tragic. Because of lowering vaccine coverage, thanks to people like McCarthy, there are a lot of people getting sick and dying. In fact, according to the website Jenny McCarthy Body Count, which tracks preventable deaths linked to the anti-vax movement, 1,061 people have been recorded killed by this level of thinking. So, as you can see, it raises a few eyebrows when a cancer charity decides to invite Jenny McCarthy as a spokesperson.
What was their reason? Just because she's a celebrity, or is there some connection that we don't know about?
Well, basically the idea was she's a celebrity. She's good at like energizing people, and she's exciting and popular and that kind of thing.
Oh, and the magic powers.
Yeah, well, that would definitely help. If you had magic powers, then absolutely. But okay, so they do this, and you know, there's a collective what from the rest of the world. So the organization started to receive dozens of emails and tweets and outrage about having McCarthy as their spokesperson. There was a Twitter campaign using the hashtag #DropJenny, and they were also asking the charity to cut ties. And eventually, it turns out, it actually worked, because Ottawa's medical, the Ottawa Cancer Agency decided to drop Jenny McCarthy. So what's interesting, though, is McCarthy tweeted Friday afternoon, "So sorry, Ottawa, I had to pull out of the event because of my new show taping conflict, but we'll be back in a few months to make up for it." Now, however, the foundation actually had a signed contract with McCarthy, so they had to negotiate some kind of financial settlement to get her out of the deal. So I hope that the skeptics who were tweeting at the cancer agency, many of them were saying things like, if you know, you drop Jenny McCarthy, I'll donate some money. Well, I hope they followed up with that, because obviously it's not easy for an organization like this to make a last-minute change. And, you know, they are dependent on donations, so hopefully people will show their support and help them out a little bit, because this is kind of important.
You know, so give the devil some credit. You know, McCarthy's tweet, of course, is to cover her own butt, because if you hear that you've been dropped, then everyone says, oh, well, there must be something wrong with her. Whereas if she does it, then it's like, oh, wow, she's so in demand that it helps her marketing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they were getting a lot of flack for this, including from Ezra Levy, who is Ottawa's medical officer of health, wrote a letter about this to the cancer agency. Additionally, you had some pretty high-profile science reporters and medical journalists who were tweeting about this. I know the Globe and Mail had an article about this. The Ottawa Citizen had an article about this. Maclean's ran a story about this. So
wow.
Pretty significant. I mean, this is good. This is that we're getting a skeptical message out there, and it's energizing people, and it's actually having a result on these organizations.
Now, I was talking to another skeptic recently about this particular issue, and they brought up something that I think I can square this sort of circle argument, but it is an important thing to bring up. So isn't this just censorship? To Jenny McCarthy has a point of view. This wasn't directly about autism, so in a sense the main cause celeb against her wasn't in this. So aren't we as skeptics sort of being heavy-handed and saying she never shall speak on anything ever again because of this sin that she had done, or she's still doing the sin, I guess.
Yeah.
But I mean does it smack of bad censorship? And how would you square that circle? That no, this isn't.
Do you want me to square the circle, or do you want to?
Well, I'm gonna give you a shot, and then I'm gonna correct you.
Okay. So, well, the way that I would look at this is that it's not censorship in the sense that, you know, government is coming down and taking away Jenny McCarthy's mouth or something. This is about a spokesperson being selected for a medical charity, and them picking someone who is fanatically anti-science. So this is a backlash. This is the cancer agency saying, hold on a second, we've just pissed off all of our supporters. We need to backtrack and make the right decision here. So if we're going to call any type of backlash censorship, then we're going to have to be calling a lot of things censorship, because this sort of thing happens a lot. And the other thing too is there is no obligation on the part of the Ottawa Cancer Society or any group to give Jenny McCarthy a platform. Like, she doesn't deserve, hasn't earned it. You know what I mean? We're not like, this isn't her a right that she has to come to Canada and spout bullshit, right? So we're under no obligations to provide her with one.
I think where I would go in a different, so, you know, you failed, Ethan, I'm sorry.
Oh, thank you.
I think I would go about it. I mean, you have the idea of backlash, but I think backlash works just as much against us as for us. So if they were bringing in Richard Dawkins, let's say, right, to speak, and there was a similar campaign, but by the religious people, and he had, I mean, that would be the backlash. But I think where this is different and why there's a more poignant aspect to it is in two areas. One, cancer research relies extensively and heavily on science. I mean, the whole point of it is scientific research to find cures. And she has proven that she has an absolute lack of understanding, in fact, a misuse of science. So she's a bad front person to begin with. But coupled with that is the idea of free speech and being able to yell fire in a theater.
Yeah.
Right? Jenny McCarthy has crossed over that I don't agree with you line to where she is culpable in deaths because of her thing. I mean, the fact that 1,000 plus at least children have died because of her advocacy makes this more than just, I don't agree with you. This has gone on to where you are a criminal in society. I mean, it's too close to that amount. So it's not even backlash. It's like you've convicted a crime against humanity by allowing thousands of children to die. 1,000 plus children to die from your advocacy, and that's why you shouldn't be associated with this area.
Well, that I think that's also a reasonable point, because you know, when we're talking about culpability, Jenny McCarthy has a lot of culpability on her shoulders. Getting back to the idea of sort of like a backlash, I mean, there was that situation where I think Dawkins was supposed to be scheduled to do a talk somewhere in America, and there was a backlash, and they canceled his venue. I think part of the reason why that's a different situation is because they had a contract with, I think it was like CFI Michigan, or I forget, with them, and they backed out of it illegally. Whereas in this case, they basically bought Jenny out because of the backlash. So it wasn't like they had violated, you know, Jenny's contract.
I wasn't going there. I was just going, okay, just because you don't like somebody and that's a backlash.
Well, I think
I think is much more morally dubious. We, of course, think it's justified because we're on, it's on our side, but objectively, it's less so.
I think that there is a certain case to be made for sort of citizen reaction, especially if you're a public relations group that depends on it, or a group that depends on public relations, you know what I mean? Like, if it was a private function type thing, they're not going to care if people complain about Jenny McCarthy. Whereas if it's a public charity that is relying on donations, it has perhaps a moral responsibility to make sure that whoever they're bringing in, you know, is speaking good science.
That'd be one thing I'm really, really curious about is, because of her stature and her record, I mean, she has created a lot of negative waves as well as other waves. Why they picked her? I mean, it does strike me as an incredibly odd.
You think they would have Googled her, you know?
Yeah, you know.
It just, yeah.
Well, no, not only that. I mean, she is kind of a has-been as far as a celebrity goes in her own right.
Yeah.
And the only thing that kind of keeps her in the news is her quack views on science and medicine.
Didn't she strangle Justin Bieber recently or something?
I think he's still alive. He didn't go to Grammys, though, because he didn't get an award. And don't ask me why I know what that, because I don't want to admit.
Okay, well,
yes.
All right, then, let's go to a break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back after this.
Science is the best tool ever devised for understanding.
To subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Empowers you.
This is Phil Plait of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
This is my life. I wake up in the morning, I eat, I sleep, I shit.
Breakfast with the Browns.
So whatever it is, but I never shut it off for 5 minutes.
I can't wait to impress my friends with my astounding knowledge of cool.
Join your favorite Brownsters and tune in and listen to the best selection of down-tempo electro-pop lounge core.
Strictly Squaresville.
Remember, subtle, basic, brown.
Breakfast with the Browns
on CITR 101.9 FM every Monday morning
from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m.
The older I get, the more life starts to make sense and the less I care.
Now we're riding the rainbow, the clouds lift, and we're making it back young. Now we're riding the rainbow to Cloudsville, and we're making it like you. Now we're riding the rainbow to Cloudsville.
You know, you can give 100 examples of what it isn't, but you're going to have a hell of a time saying what it is.
And we're back here on Radio Free Thinker.
Ethan, apparently I got a report from the RCMP just the other day that apparently you've been harassing the Prime Minister, Premier of this province. Apparently you've been following our Premier around and dogging her by accusing her of all sorts of weird... What's all this up with Christy Clark and you recently? Are you guys dating?
Most certainly not.
Oh, you'd find that offensive, I bet.
Yeah. So, important theme on today's show... Well, every show really has been secularism. And last week, I attended an event with the Premier of BC, Percy Clark, to hear her talk about faith and politics. So I blogged about this previously, but I wanted to discuss a few points here on the show. Because, you know, recently we've been seeing some pretty shocking displays of religion and politics intermingling. News has been made over the question of distributing Gideon Bibles in Chilliwack, and the BC Humanists have started a petition to get the Chilliwack School Board to stop distributing those Bibles, so go sign that. I was also in Chilliwack not too long ago. A local MP was holding a town hall meeting on faith and secularism, and it was aptly titled Beyond Secularism. And we discussed this a couple of shows ago. And that panel was moderated by Gwen O'Malley. And ironically, it was a panel about Beyond Secularism with three Christians on the panel, no one representing the secular point of view. Or really, given the fact that posters for the event featured five or six religious symbols, you had no one representing a single viewpoint that wasn't a Christian one. So, and of course, today's show, we talked about the federal government giving $500,000 to an anti-gay evangelical organization. All of us are a little concerned. So, several of us from CFI Vancouver went to see the premier at her talk on faith and politics. And if you want to see some live tweets, you can go through the back catalog on Twitter. But anyway, the event unfolded the way I thought it was going to. Clark managed to surprise me a few times because I've seen some cartoonishly bad characterizations of secularism before, but Clark upped the ante really good. She started off on a bad foot. The organizers announced they would only take written questions, which I think is a cowardly decision in my opinion, because Clark had a sort of a captive audience. There was really no reason that she should assume that this audience was going to give her a hard time. You had to pay to be there. It was $15, which is still a ripoff. And she was unchallenged. She had the only microphone. You know, they could have cut anyone off if they were ranting on. And then she goes and makes a big show of how she's this maverick, a heroic maverick for talking about faith and politics in a venue where she can't be questioned. So, I mean, you're not a maverick. You've just controlled the message. That's all you've done. You're not special in this. So, big fail there. Yes. on behalf of the organizers, which is City in Focus, a faith-based, not surprisingly, organization concerned with the soul of the city, as
so,
they put
so
it.
So you said written questions. When were these questions, like, were they pre-done questions?
Yes. So they...
Do you know if they were even like were they even fair questions, or were they like, could you have written a question and put it into the pile, or was this, because when you say written questions, that implies that there's some kind of audience participation, if not live, then prior, but if they're pre-set up questions, then they're not really even questions. They're just points.
Basically what happened was, before the event even started, they circulated these cards. They say, write your question down for Christy Clark. It's like, well, I don't know what my question is until she's going to say anything. How am I supposed to? So a few people wrote questions, and you hand them in. And then I think they maybe went through about like six of them or something like that, five or six. And they asked one question that came from one of our atheists. I'll get to that point in a minute, though. So Clark starts off by remarking on the strangeness of faith and politics, talking about the negative feedback she's gotten. Censorship. Anyway, and she mentions how this is indicative of a change in society. And that change, of course, is the fact that BC, I believe, if not, is the second or probably the first most non-religious province in Canada, maybe, or tied with Quebec, depending on which source you go through.
Well, and you have to be careful with that, too, because I think you're probably right on that, but we also have the strongest religious fanatics, especially in the area of the Kootenays and all that, where you've got a lot of, there's fundamentalist Mormons and a lot of evangelical, very strong Christian communities in BC as well, so we get kind of a both here.
Well, there's also, don't forget, Alberta's got their fair share, too.
Well, yeah, but they're really the states. They don't count.
Yeah, okay. So she mentioned how she thought it was really strange that government should not be able to give money, public money, to faith-based organizations, because she believes that the faith-based organizations are the ones that are doing good work in society, helping the poor, etc. So apparently she's just not really all that aware of, you know, secular groups like Insight or the Vancouver Food Bank or UNICEF. So she's kind of sort of presenting this, you know, faith makes good, so good gets money type connection here.
Well, and didn't we just earlier say that actually religious groups do, like religious charities do get money from the government?
Yeah, a lot more.
Just because you're religious based, you cannot get money from the government. That seems like she's not only, she's wrong.
She's painting it like the religious groups are the ones who aren't getting the lion's share, when in fact they are getting the lion's share.
Well, that is typical, and I'm sure you'll tell us more about this, is one of the growing movements in the North American religious is to paint themselves out somehow as the victim, that they are somehow the ones being persecuted, when really it's the exact opposite case.
Yeah. So Clark started talking about how her faith is really important to her as a politician. And she said this means going to church to be reminded on why she needs to be a good person. So she actually started talking about how religion makes people be good and not evil. So someone should inform Clark that atheists and non-believers actually learn to be good people without religion. It's totally possible.
Well, actually, and I think it's even worse than that if you think about it. Because, I mean, she is implicitly saying that you don't go to church, therefore you are an evil person.
Yeah.
And maybe she just means that as in you're going to go to hell because you don't believe in God. Or maybe she says, you know, Ethan, you're secretly a murderer or a thief or something because you don't go to church. And I think this is where you get a lot of the blinders on, is people who are in this community just don't see how offensive their comments are. They don't see it that way, but it is offensive. It's right up there.
Yeah.
I won't go that way.
It's a total backhanded compliment. She also remarked how it's very tragic that more people don't go to church, but I think only highlights her point that she actually thinks that unless you are a God-fearing citizen of this province, you're probably a criminal, which, again, very, very irritating. So, oh, and by the way, reality TV is bad. That's corrupting the youth of today. Meanies.
Well, okay, I don't like reality TV.
I don't like it either, but I don't think that it's having a bigger impact than, for example, politics. Did you know that politics can be very nasty sometimes?
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. So, well, anyway, it's nice to know that we're being held to higher standards than the politicians. So when she got to question time, she remarked how she was surprised that there was no open Q&A, to which I say, fail. And most of the questions were sort of softballs kind of lobbed at her, and she took her time kind of knocking them around. But there were a few interesting points that came up. One of the things that she kind of kept repeating in various ways was that secularism is bad because there are some religious groups who do nice things. And I think, again, this is just sort of this falling back on this trope, this idea that, you know, if you're religious, any religious group, any kind of religion that you follow, you're intrinsically more moral, more ethical than, you know, the nice atheist.
You know, and this leads into what I think is a major character flaw you get in some religious people. And again, not that they're innately bad people, but they set themselves up to be bad people in a way, is if honestly all you're saying is that this imaginary person in the sky is the only thing that's preventing you from going around and slashing my tires. What does that really say about you? That, you know, that if you were not somehow caged up or locked in, you admit, oh, I would be an absolutely horrible person if it wasn't for this. Where I mean, it stuns me. Whereas, I mean, me and you, we could sit back and say, well, you know, I don't slash Ethan's tires because it's the wrong thing to do, and I know it's the wrong thing to do, and I don't need the threat of some fake myth creature to prevent me from doing it. I have enough brains and enough intelligence to know that it's wrong. And some people might be offended by the fact that I use brains and intelligence, but think about it. That's not my argument. That's their argument.
Yeah. So there was one thing that she started talking about, and I was floored when she brought this point up. But hospital proselytizing.
What?
Yeah. So she wants to make it so that private information about patients in hospitals, like terminally ill patients, will be sent to religious leaders so they can come into the hospital and preach to the patients.
Why would they do that?
Well, a very good question. So on the surface, this sounds like, oh, that's a nice little gesture to help people who are religious. But let's deconstruct this for a moment. What she is saying is that if a patient is terminally ill and stuck in a hospital bed, this person's condition should be given, first of all, how? To local religious leaders, first of all, which ones? All of them? And then hospitals don't do this because it's a huge violation of privacy. So, you see, patients have rights. You can't just tell somebody, oh, by the way, John Smith has got cancer. He's going to be dead in like 2 weeks. So now's a really good time to come to him and start preaching about, you know, God and Jesus or whatever.
Well, let's not forget the ethical implications. These are very vulnerable people.
Yeah.
Right?
And yeah.
You're going there. And coincidentally, a lot of people who have sort of deathbed conversions also tend to be heavy donors to social causes because, well, you can't take it with you, so to speak. So, I mean, this is evil.
Yeah. And there, she gave no explanation of how this system is supposed to work. I mean, do hospitals have to ask permission first? What if you get some, like, religious nurse who doesn't care about asking permission and just goes around giving out all this information? And the other question is, you know, like, shouldn't you wait for the patient to say, I mean, if a patient says to the doctor, listen, can you have my priest brought over? I want to confess my... That's fine.
That's
the patient
totally
has requested, right? But this is the hospital doing it on behalf. That is not okay.
Well, and you know, and it's striking that she thinks, you know, the best thing to do is to promote this as opposed to perhaps a psychologist or something who is trained in sort of how do you deal with people who are facing life-changing events or this kind of crisis, you know, palliative kind of care.
Yeah.
Right? You know, that would be, I think, where you put your efforts into is to bring in a professional who might help with some psychological counseling. And as you point out, if that leads to bringing in a member of a religious faith, okay, that's, you know, we're not in a society that's smart enough yet to, I mean, anyhow. What about the idea then, if I'm on my deathbed, the last thing in the world I'm going to want is have some churcher come around and tell me, A, I'm going to go to hell because I haven't confessed my sins, and B, time's a ticking.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, imagine if you're not even like an atheist as in, you know, like me or Don who, you know, is so vocal about it, but if you're just like one of those quiet people who don't believe, they don't like having proselytizing down around them, and now, in this vulnerable time when they have very little time left, you bring in a priest to irritate them, and who knows what kind of, like, person this is. Maybe they're going to be sort of implying, hey, listen, make a big donation in your will to the church, you know, da 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 da, wink wink, nudge nudge.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, and I don't know if you were going to bring this up earlier, but you made some comments about this particular conference that you went to on some other place that I won't mention because they're not us, and you should always be listening to us and only us. But they told you literally to go to hell and hope you burn in hell.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, so what if you're in this very vulnerable state, you know, your emotions are very, very much tied with how your quality of life is and how long you live in these particular terminal states, and you have something like that happen. It strikes me as again, if you're in the bubble, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
But it's like she has an entirely absence of knowledge of what people are like outside of this particular context.
Particularly because there already is a system in place for this sort of thing where the patient or the patient's family can request this kind of service. It can be brought out. It doesn't need to be further handicapped by putting all these weird regulations on hospitals. So again, just a terrible, terrible idea by Clark. Another area that I thought was worth mentioning was the question of bullying. And Clark made the following statement. I tried to write this down exactly the way she said it, so I'm going to try to say it the way she said it. There are some things about bullying, you know, some things are hard to eliminate. And I'm just like, really? That's your response to this? You know, because we've seen in many different schools across BC that they've been trying to put in legislation that makes it a lot harder to bully, and especially with the concept of things like bullying gay students. And there's been backlash from people who have said, well, hold on a second. You know, I think homosexuality is a sin and they're going to burn in hell. And it's not right for you to tell me, to not tell my kids, that these kids are going to go burn in hell. So Clark, I mean, she hasn't exactly come out and said, I'm in favor of bullying, but she hasn't exactly been, you know, an ally of these groups who are trying to make it extremely hard for people who have these kind of aggressive Christian views about homosexuality.
Now, I know you're not the best steno in the world, so you didn't write much more than the line, but I mean, literally, she had to have said more than just that. That strikes me, she had to have said something more than that.
Yeah, so she kind of hand-waved on this and sort of talked about how it's really important to crack down on bullying and that kind of stuff. But there was no tangible impact, no tangible plan that she put in place. It was just this kind of really vague. And then she sort of immediately segued into things like homelessness and gay marriage. And that was interesting because she comes out and says how, you know, gay marriage is a right and you know, I'm going to support gay marriage. And then at the end goes, but I don't want to offend religious people. It's just like, really? That's where you go with this? Come on. Like, if are you going to say that, listen, if a church wants to discriminate, say, for a mixed marriage, a mixed race marriage, that's perfectly reasonable. We can't offend the church, right? It's like, no, no, I think that we have moved beyond that point in our sort of civil rights struggle, have we not?
Well, and it strikes me as odd that that's her benchmark. You know, I don't want to offend religious people. If she had almost said, I don't want to offend the citizens of BC, okay, I mean, she is the elected representative of the citizens of BC, and in so much as religious communities are part of that. But it strikes me she has must have a very interesting view of what religion kind of means in a way. Because, correct me if I'm wrong, and, you know, when's the last time I've been to church? But the Bible is supposed to be the Word of God. And you have to follow this particular document, because if you don't follow it, you go straight to hell. Now, again, religious people have always had the difficulty of picking and choosing what they're supposed to adhere to, because you can't literally follow the entire the Bible. In fact, I was listening the other day about a woman in the United States who was a year on the Bible. And she tried to literally follow everything in the Bible for a year. And she had some cheats, because again, it was a lot. But I mean, it brought home to her the sort of stupidity of a lot of the rules in there. Although she came out as still a religious person. But I mean, Christy Clark must sit back and, if it says in part of the Bible that you must stone wayward children or that sort of thing, well, how does she square that as, you know, the Bible is good, I'm a Bible person and it's my moral code, but there are all these evil, bad things in it?
Well, that was interesting. One of the questions that got asked by one of our CFI folk was basically the same question. How can you use the Bible as a source of inspiration for politics when it's full of contradictions? And her reply was basically, well, it's not static. It's a teaching document. It's debatable. So, I mean, if you try to, like, expand this analogy, I mean, imagine trying to learn math, where the rules occasionally change. So sometimes 2 plus 2 is actually 5. Can you, is that a really good teaching document, you know?
Well, and there is the idea, so murder is wrong, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, so you have, like, the Ten Commandments. It depends on the situation. Let's debate this particular thing. Which, at that point, and this is where again, it strikes me as stunningly deaf, is at that point, that's no longer, the Bible's no longer your measuring stick. You're having a debate about is X or Y right or wrong, and you're bringing in everything else to make that decision. You've left the Bible behind.
That's the point. The Bible is static. It is supposed to be dogma. What's non-static is the mental gymnastics that we go through to try to hand-weave these contradictory passages into some semblance of a moral narrative. That's where it's a teaching document, because it's you're teaching yourself how to go, okay, it says I can't do X, and it says here I have to do X. So maybe if I do, wait, maybe if it's on Tuesday, it's okay, but not Sunday, but not in January. And then I should, you know what, I'm just going to build the stupid pipeline. So again, the Bible, this notion, this hanging her hat on the Bible as some kind of valuable tool for navigating the world of moral quandaries is sort of like, I don't think she's read the Bible, honestly.
Does she have any other interesting views?
Oh, she said a few other things, but I guess we can wrap things up here. With regards to, I guess, one of the few nice things that she actually said, and that was on the subject of genetically modified food. She noted that human beings have been doing this for about 10,000 years already, and she is right about that, so...
No, Jesus, she gets that wrong. We haven't been here for 10,000 years. The Bible tells me that.
6,000, yes, of course. But, so that's sort of where things ended up. Again, you know, I think that this is... The take-home message of this is that we're not as secular as we think we are here in BC, and we need to stop relying on sort of apathy and this notion of live and let go, because that's not what's happening here. We actually are in a fight over secular issues here in Canada.
Well, I'm kind of curious about one thing, Ethan. Mm. So this was an interesting discussion she had, And from what I understand, and my memory sometimes fails me, but this has been the most churching a modern premier has wrapped themselves into. Now, most people are aware, who are following politics to any certain degree, knows that the upcoming election, the Liberals are going to get a shellacking. That, you know, it's more than likely there's going to be a massive majority for the NDP. And in an odd sort of sense, if I was Christy Clark, I would be desperate for every vote I get. So in the one sense, pandering to this religious community kind of makes sense. But as you point out, there's a cost for doing that.
Mm.
And when she wants to have the broadest appeal, narrowing in on this religious group strikes me as a gamble. Do you have any ideas what she might? You're much more liberal than I am. I'm far more of a communist to really understand the machinations of liberal minds.
Well, I mean, first of all, the whole concept of the sort of liberal party is odd because they're not really the liberal party. They're more like the conservative party. And the, quote, conservative party is more sort of like the crazy conservative party. But,
and to round that out, the NDP here are more like the liberals federally. So
yeah, it's really weird. But anyway, one of the things that I've heard, I don't know if this is really testable in any sense of the word, but that when the BC Conservatives sort of came back on the scene under, I think it's John Cummings or something, the Liberals kind of panicked and surged to the right in an effort to secure their voting base. And in doing so, they kind of lost center control. So they lost their hold on the center, which went to the NDP. And then the Conservatives kind of imploded anyway. And so now they've surged to the right for no real good reason. And now they're stuck there. And so you hear Christy Clark constantly going on about families and values and morals and on and on and on. So, I mean, it depends on what happens, I guess, in the next election, I mean.
Yeah, well, you know, maybe it's, you know, circling the trailers, wagon, sorry, you know, for the attack. So they know they're going to lose, but if they can clamp down their support in key regions, they'll stay alive for the next battle. Who knows? I am hoping the NDP government, if it's elected, will introduce proportional representation, but that's a whole other issue and a whole other topic.
Yes, yes.
So, Ethan, I have one question for
you.
Yeah, yeah. We're just going to switch topics here, but we have to talk about it. You know, there is the white, scary Nazi in the room who has quit the Pope.
Yes.
Apparently you have some things to say about the Pope. Well, you had some things. It was an interesting blog.
Thank you.
So he quit. Why did he quit?
Well, apparently this Pope was kind of feeling his age. I guess that hat's really heavy. And said, you know what, I'm not feeling this anymore. And he's flying the coop.
I saw a hilarious cartoon the other day about a couple outside of the Vatican, and there's white smoke coming out of it, and one of them says, oh, either they've elected a new pope, or they're burning the documents.
Yes, yes.
This has been one pope who's had more than his share of controversies. I won't go into the conspiracy theories too much, but one of the things I think is going to be really interesting in following this, especially as an outsider, is who's going to replace him. I mean, one of the things that has been floated, one of the reasons why he's retiring, isn't so much because of his health, which obviously is a huge issue, but that if he retires, he has a lot of control over who will replace him.
Mm.
And he's very much of a conservative who wants to maintain this sort of conservative mold in the church. And by leaving early, he can sort of ensure that the apostolic continuation is in this conservative mode. And there's been a lot of actually interesting challenges. I mean, one of the things, and I hope this is just craziness on our part, but a Canadian is supposed to be up for, there's a cardinal from Quebec who's supposed to be one of the front runners. But the real interesting debate is between the Latin Americans and the Africans, right? I mean, there's an Italian guy in the running in the Vatican's in Italy, you figure, hey. But the reason why those are interesting is they're both big areas of growth for conservatism. But in Latin America, you tend to have a much more liberal form of Catholicism coming out. I mean, still religious, still kind of all the evilness. But in Africa, you have much more of this fundamentalist, this let's kill the gays kind of move. And because there's more and more people in these areas of growth, their influence on who gets elected to be pope is much more important. So there is the possibility of, well, a huge possibility the next pope will not be from Europe at all, and that he may be from Africa, which would be, well, really scary for the church, I think, and much fodder for our show.
Well, I think that basically there actually is sort of no win scenario with this, because they're just going to replace him
from what I've heard, all of the candidates are worse than him in terms of their views on everything. So it's just going to get worse. The only hope is that it gets so ridiculous that people just start walking away, which is, I think, you know, sort of been happening already.
Well, and again, the reports that I've been hearing have been pointing out one of the reasons why, too, there's very unlikely that a European pope will be elected again is there are next to no practicing Catholics left in Europe. You know, yeah. Even Italy, which, I mean, is synonymous with Catholicism, the churches there apparently are, like, empty. You know, you get, like, two people who show up, and both of them are your grandmother kind of thing, right?
Yeah. Well, let's go on to our skeptical highlights to close out the show. I have two of them here. So the first one is an upcoming cafe inquiry, the controversies of the DSM-5 and mental health with Dale Bierstein. This is happening on Saturday, February 16th at 1 p.m. in room 1505 of SFU Harbor Center. So the fifth edition of the Diagnostics and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association is ready to be released in May. So there's been many critics of the previous editions, and they have focused on the sheer number of diagnoses contained inside these manuals and the vagueness of the symptoms used to diagnose the mental illnesses. So Dale Bierstein has been involved in the skeptics movement for 40 years. He has also been a consultant to the ethics committee of the BC Mental Health and Addiction Services. And he's going to lead a discussion about the controversies of the DSM and some of these vague descriptions of mental illness.
I think one of the most dubious things in this new manual is apparently criticism of the manual itself is classified as a mental disease.
That's very circular.
Yes.
My next highlight is Darwin Shadows, Family, Friends, and Influences with Dr. Greg Bull. This is happening Thursday, February 28th at 7 p.m. at SFU Harbor Center, room to be announced. So you probably know some of the interesting things about Darwin himself, but how much do you know about the people that surrounded him and supported him? Exploring the family and friends who influenced the life of Charles Darwin. What is the origin of the origin of species? Dr. Greg Bull is an instructor teaching evolution, ecology, and genetics in the Department of Department of Zoology and Botany at UBC. And the event is by donation, suggested $5 or $10. And this, of course, is a CFI lecture, so you'll probably learn a whole lot about science and skepticism and critical thinking.
I doubt that.
Oh, you will.
Sorry. So I've got one this week. Simon Fraser University Human Evolutionary Studies Program is having their second annual symposium. It's Cooperation, Conflict, and Cultural Evolution of Religion. This symposium seeks to change the state of affairs by bringing together archaeologists, anthropologists, psychologists to discuss the hypothesis that religious beliefs and practices facilitate an emergence on large-scale, complex society, the enhancement of groups within. A bunch of people are going to get together. They're going to talk about where does religion come from, what's its purpose in society, from a scientific standpoint, not from a social or religious standpoint. That's being held this Friday at 8 p.m. at SFU. There'll be a link on our website. Also, a show note, you notice our bit on the Pope was a little abridged. And part of that was, you know, in the essence of fair and balance, we tried to get a representative from the other side. And I spent most of today praying to, get some response from God, Jesus, or the Holy Ghost. But all my attempts and requests were silenced, so we couldn't have him on the show today, but we did try.
Well, I guess we can close out today. First of all, happy Darwin Day, everybody.
Happy Darwin Day.
And this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying, eyes on, minds open.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion.